So that's how we started. Two Italians and two Jews. Funny combination, huh? Frankie, he liked to worry, so he paid off the cops. Benny liked to brawl, so he was our muscle. And me and Maya, we were both the leader. At least it started out that way. Just four mugs off the street. At first, we were penny ante, but together, we grew.
The following podcast is a Carolina Boys production. Welcome back, everyone, to Crime and Entertainment. I'm your host, Hollywood Wade, and we hope everyone enjoyed our Behind the Gangster episode last week. That was over on YouTube. Whenever we do Behind the Gangster episodes, we usually let it go a week before we put it over on audio. So that will be getting over here this week. We done Jimmy Burke from the movie Goodfellas. So that's why you didn't get an audio episode last week. It's just some legalities when we put out those episodes. We have to give it a week before it goes over to audio. But a new episode here for you this week. We interview Chris Cipollini, who's an accomplished author, award-winning author, written books on a number of high-profile individuals in the organized crime world. Lucky Luciano, for one. That was the movie Mobsters that you heard in the trailer there. Murder, Inc., which was the notorious murder-for-hire gang. Back in those days. Also, Diary of a Motor City Hitman, Chester Wheeler Campbell story, and then some other stuff that he's got working on. I think you guys will really find this interesting. You know, a lot of similarities in how he kind of got hooked into this genre, as well as myself. It's really fascinating reading about all these characters and, you know, the things they done. And each individual can spawn you off in so many different directions. Because just like doing it with Luciano here, you know, then you get looking into Murder, Inc. And then with Murder, Inc., you have guys, you know, like Albert Anastasia and like Lepke Buckalter. So it can just spawn you in so many different directions when you're diving into these subjects. So let's not waste any time, folks. Let's get right into it here on Crime and Entertainment with Chris Cipollini. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. Now, I have here a very special guest, and I say that because me and this guy have been talking for really probably months now. He's turned me on to a few guests, and I kept telling him, I got to get you on the show, you know, share your story of the things you've done, because he writes a lot of books about stuff that I'm a big reader of. He was even kind enough to send me one a while back, book on Lucky Luciano here. Now, I usually keep this right here in the back throughout all my interviews, because it's a really great book, and that's not the only one he's wrote. So we want to welcome to the show Chris Cipollini. Chris, how you doing, my friend?
Good. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm glad we could make it happen.
Yeah, we've been trying to knock it down. We've had some weather, you know, delays in the last couple of weeks. I'm here in Charleston, South Carolina, and we've had some tornadoes touch down over the last week, so we had to push it back. But I'm glad we're able to get to it and knock it out. I guess like most stories, man, before we get into what you write about and why you chose those topics, we'll kind of start with you and, you know, your upbringing, where you grew up, that type of thing. And then eventually what led you in the path to become a writer?
Path to writer. I think that was the only thing I knew I was any good at a very young age. I had no idea what I would do with it. I just knew in elementary school that I sucked at a lot of stuff, but I did. Like, I don't know what it was, but that I kind of knew I had a handle on. You just have no idea what are you going to do with that. Later in life, I always say that it wasn't this overnight thing. I decided I'm going to go into this. It was more like a slow burn. My dad was a narcotics cop. I had some friends from the other side of the tracks. You put that together. Go through life, I realized, okay, well, I can write. What do I do with this? And I love to read biographies and, you know, social, cultural, political kind of books. And it kind of came together. You know, you stumble on you know, some of these old mob stories, and I realized how much it was intertwined with society in general. I mean, dating back to the turn of, you know, 20th century. So long story short, I realized I had a knack for finding the metaphorical needle in a haystack, looking at research and being able to find, again, I'm not good at a lot of things, but I was somehow found out I was pretty good at finding those weird bits of history that maybe somebody else missed. So yeah, and there we go. And I became truly fascinated with the mob or the darker corners of society and culture. So
right,
that's what did it.
Now, you grew up, we talked a little bit earlier off camera, you grew up in Pittsburgh?
Yes, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, born and raised.
There's a lot of steel plants and stuff down there, isn't there? Or used to be?
Yeah. Yeah. Used to be the remnants of it's, you know, Pittsburgh is a blue collar city. That is not an exaggeration. Cool city. Definitely. You know, in East Coast, it, like anything up in the Northeast, you know, there's that aura of it. But yeah, it's not Philly.
Right.
For sure. That's like two different worlds.
Yeah, but totally different.
Yeah. But yeah, Pittsburgh's cool. Yeah, and it had its own mob thing. It's, and I would hear about that from my dad. Like growing up, my dad didn't talk a lot about work, just to go back to what you said earlier or asked. But it was interesting because later in life when I started going, oh yeah, I remember dad talking about, you know, this mob stuff and how it was related to New York and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm a welder, and I worked for about 15 years in a steel mill down here. And I know they have a lot of steel mills down there, and that's always been, I mean, I'm a blue collar worker at heart. You know, I've only recently gotten into this over the last year, and I still weld like to this day. That's my day job. But, yeah, different world altogether. Cause I've never actually been in Pittsburgh, but I have taken some trips to Philly, and it's definitely a different world. Even their football fans, like when Carolina Panthers have a game against Pittsburgh, like there's been numerous times where I've been to those games and we've been outnumbered as fans in our own damn stadium. Like they travel a lot.
they're you know, and I love Philly. It's just, they are sports crazy, and so is Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
I think the only reason in the NFL it isn't the rivalry is because they're from different divisions, the Steelers and
AFC, NFC.
Like hockey, vicious. The baseball, two different divisions. But hockey, the Flyers and the Penguins, that's a good game.
Yeah, I know. I took a trip up to Philly years back when they had a Monday night game up there, and everybody was like, man, I wouldn't wear that Panther jersey if I were you. Not up there, because their fans are brutal and unforgiving. I mean, don't get me wrong, they broke my balls for sure, but at the end of the day, they were all, it was more just, you know, good fun, good humor. You know, I didn't get in any altercations, but at the same time, I know better than to go in a town like Philly and start mouthing off too. I mean, you gotta, you know, where you're at and how to conduct yourself.
You don't go right. You don't go.
I mean, they beat up Santa Claus
in Philly. Yeah, right. And they're not in, you know, Philly people aren't going to come to a Pittsburgh game and just, I mean, some might, but
yeah,
generally, no, everything's cool. It's just, it's a good heated rivalry. So.
Okay. So when you realize that this was your knack, you know, writing, and I'm kind of like you, I've always been fascinated with that life. What was kind of like that turning pivotal moment that you seen something about organized crime that sent you in that direction, that that's what you were going to start writing about?
Okay. Unlike my broad journey into it, there was a moment. And I think this moment, I say this in jest now, I think it horrified my parents because it did. That would have been 1989, 1990 era. I dropped out of college, or got kicked out, really, my first time. I ended up going back years later. But yeah, it was nothing. There was no great story behind that. I just screwed up. But anyway, so me and a few of my friends, who similar situations happened, we're trying to take some classes at the local community college just so we wouldn't get too far behind. Right. You know, one day we're in the library and they had copies of the New York Times. And there's this guy in this dressed up in the dapper to the T. And we're like, who is this dude? Start reading about it. Boom. John Gotti. I know, whatever people say, good, bad, ugly. I know I immediately was drawn to that story. Went back to see what he had done in, you know, the mid 80s, because I was still, you know, kind of young then. But anyway, that was the to put it in a nutshell. That was the pivotal moment, was John Gotti on the New York Times. Teflon Don drew me in.
Yeah. As far as like actual mob and somebody that was in the mob, we're not talking movies here. Gotti was probably my first to that I seen that I kind of got infatuated with the real life side of things. I think I had seen Goodfellas might have been the first mob movie I seen. And then just seeing all that and hearing Henry Hill's story. And I know a lot of people would say that, you know, he didn't have as much pull or swag as he did, you know, whatever. It was still a great movie. You know, one of the best mob movies there is. Just the way they were, had everything at their disposal and just having that kind of power and clout throughout that town. And that kind of drew me in. So then I went down the rabbit hole of all the other mob movies. And then I actually seen Goodfellas before I seen The Godfather. So I seen Goodfellas and then Godfather. And then years later, you had Casino and then Donnie Brasco. So I just became enamored with the way that was. And then I started to dive into the actual real people and doing, you know, my own research and just watching documentaries or whatever I could get my hands on. Because like you said, it just fascinated me, you know, not the fact that they're killing people. That's irrelevant. And to them, that's part of the job. That's like, you know, me going and knowing that I'm going to probably cut something, you know, a piece of metal or something. That's part of the job. To them, that was part of the job. It was almost like war. It was casualties of war. And just the way they were able to pull off everything that they did, it was really, really, like you said, I guess, just interesting. Interesting. It was the best way I could put it. Was he in jail at that time? When did Gotti go to jail?
When did it, was it 91? They finally made it stick.
It was early 90s. Sentenced.
Yeah, it was shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
But similar to what you're saying, what it did for me, and I don't want to speak for my friends, but a couple of them were like going along with it. We were all fascinated. It made me, here's the good side of it. It made me go out and consume so many books that I don't know that I would have read before. And I was kind of, I was a kid who read books. I mean, I was kind of an introvert as a kid, so I would read books. But that moment made me want to go out and actually research for my own entertainment or whatever. At the time, I wanted to learn. I'm like, wait, how does this really work? Dad had talked about it, though. He didn't deal a lot with the mafia. He dealt a little more with like motorcycle clubs and typical 80s. Everybody was dealing coke. So like it could be a doctor or a hairdresser. But he loved the mob movies and he would watch The Godfather. I was like, you know, how little, sitting there like, I don't understand. Yeah. You know? And then after the Gotti thing, it just made me start going to the library. So, I mean, that was actually a positive thing. I'm at the library reading books about this, and not to, you know, go off on a tangent, but the book that really made the difference for me, I've told this story before, but a friend of mine and I went to a book fair. It was a charity book fair, used books, selling it for a charity cause. I found the first edition of The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano. And they literally charged you by the inch, and it was thick, so it cost me like 50 cents. But I read that whole thing, and I was so enamored, to use your word. I was enamored by this. But what brought me to become an eventual historian is I learned that that book was possibly a lot bullshit.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, I love that book. Yes, but And that is, so those are the two moments, the Gotti thing for better or worse, then picking up that copy of The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano.
Okay. Now, but the first book you wrote, what was the first one you wrote? Was that The Diary of the Motor City Hitman?
Yes. The first book that I wrote was Diary of a Motor City Hitman, the Chester Wheeler Campbell story. That, and I had done freelance journalism for, God, it had to be like 8-10 years. And I happened to, you know, with Facebook and social media coming, I networked with like Seth Ferranti, a couple book publishers. And yeah, and eventually I was, I'm going to write my own book, but what the hell do I write it about? And I found Chester, or the story, rather, right? Because he had been dead. But yeah, that was my first book. I didn't take on Lucky myself until the second book.
Okay. Now, Chester, at that time, was he already in prison when you started this, or?
No, Chester already passed away.
Oh, he was already dead. Okay.
I found out in research. Yeah, he had, it's not giving anything away. He died in 2001 while in federal prison.
Okay.
I don't want to say what the cause of death was.
Right.
I'll let somebody read that. It's a tragic end to a gangster story, but not exactly what you would think. It's almost anticlimactic to the point it's, oh, that's just kind of sad.
Yeah. Now, when you started doing that research, how did you, who did you contact anybody to go about, you know, getting into his background? I mean, we talked earlier off air about, you know, Scott Bernstein, and there's other guys that are really synonymous with Detroit. Did you have anybody you reached out to help you kind of, you know, get the ball rolling on that?
Yeah. Two major players, Scott Bernstein, you know, when he came, it was a big help during and after, and my lawyer. It just was ironic that my attorney friend lived outside Detroit, and he kind of spearheaded on my behalf, digging into places that even a journalist not necessarily can get into.
Ah,
and wow. And I remember when I did the book proposal to the publisher, and to paraphrase, he was kind of like, if you can get a whole book on this guy, I'll give it to you. He actually knew who Chester was, but had mentioned not many people. There's not a lot. There was a lot, but understandably, most journalists or people outside Detroit have never even heard of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I had a lot of help. I was fortunate to get in contact with some attorneys who had been part of the trials, a judge even that was involved, some old head gangsters, you know, give me their insight. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Now, without giving too much away, because obviously if you're interested in this guy's story, we want you to go pick up this book and read it for yourself, but just give us a small insight. Cause I heard you talk and tell a story about how this guy had, I don't know if it was stuff four hits or whatever, but I'm assuming by this, and this is just going off, you know, what I put together, he didn't necessarily work for anybody. He was kind of a freelance hitman that would do whatever, or am I wrong on that? Because you're saying, I think one time he got pulled over and he had documents that most people should not have access to. And that's kind of dangerous because you don't, if somebody up high is giving him them documents, then, you know, they got access to a lot more stuff. And that's pretty dangerous when it gets into the hands of somebody like him.
That's what frightened everybody at the time in the 1970s, is he had information, which is far more dangerous than any weapon, which he had a lot of those as well. But it was, when you have the goods on your enemies, you have the goods on your friends, you have the goods on everybody. That's some creepy stuff. It scared people. How did he get grand jury testimony that was sealed?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot of corruption in Detroit, as Bernstein, I'm sure, has mentioned or will tell you when he's on. At that time in the 1970s, there were a lot of corruption issues being brought to light. Chester was kind of in the middle of it. What was he, though? I say this all the time. Chester was like the 007 of the Detroit underworld of the 1970s. it was feared and rightfully so, but kind of a mystery, an elusive character, an enigma, if you will, that nobody could really put their finger on. Okay, did he kill all these people or did he arrange it? Why are all these names in his notebooks? He was basically freelance, but we all kind of agree there was evidence to show he worked for the African-American drug factions, and he also worked for the Italian-American mob. And though he was freelance, he certainly had leaning of alliances to certain sides as opposed to others.
Right.
But technically, he was a freelance hitman. I think he was better described as like a spy. I mean, really, it was unusual too, because you think of the time period that this black guy is working so closely with these other factions. It just, it's amazing. Yeah. He was that good at what he did.
Yeah. And that wasn't commonplace, you know, back in those days, unfortunately, for that kind of relationship to be had. I mean, I'm not saying it's never happened. You know, from what I understand, Frank Lucas had a decent relationship with the Italians in New York. I think if they seen that you were somebody, I mean, just what the mob does, if they see that you're beneficial in whatever it is you do, whether it be making money or clipping people or whatever the case, you know, they will build a relationship with you, but it's just not something you see a lot, or you saw a lot of, especially during that period of time, like you said.
Right, right. And Detroit, I give credit for, of all the mob central cities that you think of, Detroit was truly a unique anomaly in and of itself in that way. Even the way it worked, Frank Lee Usher, who was a big narcotics figure at that time and a friend of Chester's, was groomed and very well protected by the Italian mob. You know, you didn't hear as much of that kind of relationship in other cities. Yes, it happened. I mean, green is the only color that ultimately matters.
Absolutely.
But in Detroit, they had a really unique kind of thing going on. Just, you know, as a historian, I'm saying, wow, that place was different.
Yeah, since I talked with Gunner, and me and him become pretty close sharing stories back and forth, and he's from Detroit, he's told me a lot. And that was probably one of the cities that I knew had, you know, a underworld there as far as the mafia, but I didn't know a whole lot about it. And when I started, you know, I've started reading his book and then listening to some stuff that was more centered around Detroit. We had Johnny Curry on the show. He was involved more of the drug side of things, but just that whole city had a lot of corruption going on. And the more I'm diving into it, like, they had their own thing going on down there, and there was a lot of stuff that went on. So I'm having fun kind of going down that side of the rabbit hole, because obviously I'm familiar with the New York stuff and the Philly stuff, but that's another town that I think really don't maybe get the credit for the powerhouses that they had down there.
And part of the reason I wrote the book, when I realized writing the book, researching, there was so much going on even at that time that indirectly related to what Chester's role was. So I had to throw some of that in there, because it was so vast, such a dynamic, complex thing. You even had the Hoffa disappearance happen just months after Chester got arrested, and that blew up like, whoa, what is going on here? Conspiracy trials, entire police precincts were under fire for dealing drugs out the back door that they, yeah, that city, it's an intricate, incredible story. And that's just the 1970s,
right?
You know, let alone everything else.
Yeah, when Curry was, you know, doing his thing in the 80s there, I mean, hell, he was married to the mayor of Detroit's niece, Coleman Young. And then the guy that was running the Detroit homicide division, who was also the guy in the Beverly Hills Cop movies, Gil Hill. He played Axel's boss in the Beverly Hills Cop movies. He was actually the police homicide detective, like head over homicide in Detroit. And, you know, they had him under suspicion for a lot of things. I don't think either one of them ever got convicted of anything, but they were definitely under suspicion and they tried to get him. I mean, Curry told us on his interview that they dangled everything they could in front of him to turn over, you know, the mayor, and he wouldn't do it.
So. Polarizing figures and a lot of stuff in that city that, yeah, sadly, like you said, outside of Detroit, a lot of people don't know because they, mm-hmm, constantly focus, and for obvious reasons, you know, focus on New York, mm-hmm, or Atlantic City or Philly, you know, but there's plenty of other things going on.
Oh yeah, for sure. So you knock out that one. Then, like you said, you bought that diary or manuscript or whatever you said you had there. Did you know that was going to be your second book? Did you know that after, all right, you've done this first one, you kind of got a game plan of how it was. Did you know that was the book you wanted to write for your second book?
Yeah, deep down in my subconscious, ever since, you know, 1990, 91, when I bought that alleged memoir of, mm-hmm, Lucky Luciano and found out it was, you know, a contentious, debated subject, its authenticity, I always knew I would write a book on Luciano, and then the chance presented itself.
Now, is this the book that he was supposedly writing at the time of his death?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I always heard that there was a book being written. That's another thing about Lucky. There's tons of stories out there that, you know, some people say are true, some people say are not true. And then, you know, there's so much mystique around him about how he kind of, you know, put everything together. Then before that, you know, the two bigger bosses, what was it? Maranzano
and Messeria.
Messeria. I mean, like how he kind of played those. And then I think you talked in another podcast and it was portrayed in the movie Mobsters. You know, he got that big scar. I mean, there's so much mystique. How did you know and find out exactly what was fiction and what was actually truth? How did you go about doing that?
First, there were other books about Lucky, mm-hmm, that had come out around that time and more contemporary. So I read a lot of those. Some great writers found interesting things, and I read the arguments from those who, you know, basically said the Last Testament was, you know, made up. And I agree with that, by the way, too, because a lot of facts that existed before that book were written in police files and newspaper articles completely went against what,
yeah,
was written in that book. But I reached out to other experts, true authorities on organized crime, and found things in places like The Informer Journal, Tom Hunt, really a wealth of knowledge, a few of my other colleagues, I could name them all. But then I went and looked into archives where I could find things. But interestingly, a lot of what I found that struck me as great little anecdotes were in newspaper interviews with Lucky Luciano in the 1950s. Like, it just seemed to me odd. Like, few people have ever seen that he actually sat down and, like, explained some of this. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, you know, take things, you know, with a grain of salt.
Right.
But it made me discover a lot of what I did with that book is I tried to dispel some of the myths, throw in some neat little truth is stranger than fiction kind of anecdotal things. But like you said, with the scar and the story that had been run into the ground. No, he got the scar. He was beat up and left for dead. But really, it probably was cops who were looking for somebody else that, mm-hmm, they knew he was friends with.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a rival. Let's put it that way. It was the police. And, you know, I've talked about this too, the nickname. Oh, he got named Lucky because he survived that ride. No, he had a big tattoo on his forearm that he got when he was about 14 years old that said Lucky. So
that's cool too. I didn't know that he had tattoos.
Yeah, he hid them. that was a big thing. I've talked about this before. He was so conscious of cameras. Mm-hmm. The only people that knew he had tattoos were his very intimate friends and the police, who wrote it in files that even the press didn't necessarily see back in the 1930s.
Right.
Yeah. Until he kind of lightened up and wear short sleeve shirts. But generally, his forearms had tattoos, which was odd.
I don't know very many gangsters, especially back in those days, that had tattoos.
And his were dated 1912. So at least one of them he got that early. So, you know, we can, conjecture, why did he hide them all the time? Was it because of social, you know, frowning upon, or he just didn't like them anymore? Who knows? But yeah, he had them.
Yeah, I mean,
it made it interesting to the myths about him in dispelling. That's why I thought it was important.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, but, you know, I've always heard that thing where they don't typically like wise guys to have mustaches, because if it ever gets to a point to where you need to go on the run, then you can grow that mustache or full beard and, you know, not be quite as noticeable. And I don't know if that's 100% accurate or not. I never seen Lucky with anything like that, but that's one of those things. I don't know if tattoos was kind of on that list because they don't want anything directly identifying you. That could have been, you know, something. It seems like that would have been a point of contention. But you know, who, like I said, he hit him very well. I never knew he had him. Never at all.
Right. Yeah. If you really look at some of the photos where he's even caught in short sleeves, he is, my favorite is in 1936 when they nailed him before they brought him back to New York. They got him in Arkansas. The photo the press got of him in his like polo style shirt, he's sitting there with almost a smirk, and you can, he just carefully one of these numbers.
Yeah.
And because I knew exactly where the tattoos were, like he always knew, I got to keep that covered.
And he was a very smart guy. And for any of our listeners that don't know anything about the mob or La Cosa Nostra, he is kind of credited of putting together the structure and organization in the organized crime, if you will. Now, I think to that point, everything is kind of accurate, right? That where he kind of got everybody together. And this is after he took out the two bosses, or was he that much of a play in taking out those two bosses? I guess let's start with that before we get into him kind of organizing things. Was the kind of the basis of the movie Mobsters somewhat true? Because there was their two main bosses there in the town with Faranzano and the, what's the other one? Masseria. Okay. Yeah. Did he, that was him that kind of decided, just because it was to a point to where he was going to have to either join one or clip them both and become his own man, so to speak.
That's exactly the issue that Lucky had. Is he's working for one boss, the other boss is winning, but, and they're not real happy with the direction. But what it even made this possible, and yeah, that movie was right about that. I mean, every biopic has some
hints of truth.
Yeah. And it was, there were two warring bosses, but these younger guys, the key thing, Lucky didn't do this on his own. It was almost a necessary evil and survival that he and his buddies, you don't do anything on your own. Not a writer, not a mob boss. You need other people. So what was amazing about this story is they got everybody on board. We got to take this boss out. Wait a few months and see how things are going. Once we pledged our loyalty, you know, to this other guy, when they saw it was going to go the direction they feared, even more people were on board. So it's easier to pull off a coup d'etat when you have an entire ensemble cast behind you. So you figure you had the Jews, the Italians, you had everybody from Capone in Chicago to the Purple Gang in Detroit. Everybody was on board. And I say this all the time, way before social media, it's amazing to me that these guys were able to coordinate.
Yeah.
The two biggest mob hits of 1931 and basically restructured the mob.
Now, was that one, did it go down in a restaurant like it was portrayed in that film?
Yes. Masseria did get hit in a restaurant where he felt safe. He was paranoid and rightfully so, but they got him to a restaurant predestined, you know, get the restaurant owner to take a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his own men whom he felt comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
They took him out there. Now, as for Maranzano, that was going to be harder because now he proclaims himself king and he is worried these new guys, if they were able to do that, I better watch my back. What led to it is Luciano was slipped a piece of paper that had a whole lot of names on it, including his, and he was told, this is the list of people Maranzano wants hit. So that's what brought, they were like, everybody was on it. Dutch Schultz, Frank Costello, mm-hmm. Luciano, Vito Genovese, yeah, Capone. They were all going to supposedly on the list. So Luciano had to go and get the Jewish guys to do it. Why? Because Maranzano had no idea who any of them were. There was no way the Italian guys were going to be able to walk into his office and take him out.
Right.
So and that's then, it in a nutshell.
And they posed as IRS agents at the time. That's how they were able to get in there.
There's two stories. They came in as police or they came in as treasury agents. I've also heard they came in as immigration officers. So in any event, between 3 and 5 people came in, Jewish gangsters, and allegedly one was an Italian guy because they needed somebody to point out that's Maranzano.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they do that. And then after that, is that kind of when, I guess, the quote unquote commission was kind of formed, the structure of the mob, if you will, from there on out? Because, I mean, I know in the movie, he kind of invites all the heads of the people to the table. But I mean, I think something similar, at least, you know, close to that kind of took place. And he gave that mob that structure going forward. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, essentially, they set up what would become known as the Five Families, the mm-hmm. original, you know, formation of the Five Families in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was Buffalo, Kansas City, Cleveland, you know, Al Capone had Chicago. You know, that changed a little bit over the years. But basically, the idea was there's not going to be a king of kings, boss of all bosses.
Right.
It's going to be basically a board of directors. Now, also in that same time period, they had what we generally call the commission.
Mm-hmm.
Broader speaking, was also the Jewish gangsters. You had the Five Families, the mafia, which was part of this bigger board, this syndicate, which included like Meyer Lansky and Louis Lepke Buchalter,
yep.
Guys like that. Benny Siegel, mm-hmm. you know, they were all on this larger, you know, if you're looking at it as like a company, the umbrella company, mm-hmm. and then the Five Families. But Luciano spearheaded it. He's credited like the figurehead. But it really was all of those people that made it happen.
Yeah, it was a collective effort, so to speak. He was just kind of the one that maybe, I guess, started the message, if you will. Look, I think we can get a lot further if everybody kind of has their own piece of the pie, like you said, as opposed to one guy being the boss of bosses. Cause it seems like, and I mean, even since then, when everybody had their own families, as we've talked about, you know, between you and I, when somebody's at that top spot, you've always got somebody wanting to come for it and knock you down. So you still have that threat of getting knocked off that top spot. But especially if someone was running everything, you got to think that is the desirable goal. Just like whatever job you may have, if it's a, you know, a warehouse worker job or whatever, your job is to hopefully, or it should be eventually, to get to the top. And it's no different than that. So you know that people are going to be gunning for that position.
And I think they were cognizant of that as well. Yeah. I we weren't there, but based on what we know, it seems like they thought it out, at least enough on the basic things. You know, we don't want some one person in charge being this, you know, omnipotent ruler, but we also don't want ourselves to be targets all the time either. So let's make it more like, you know, dare I say, democracy and some, you know, loosely.
Now, there's an interesting story that I wanted to get your take on here for people that don't know. Like Lucky, he was obviously, he was eventually hit. Well, they got him for prostitution, right? They, because they couldn't really get him on too much else. They hit him with the prostitution charge. But while he was in jail, there's reports of him basically helping with information during a war or something like that. Is that, is those information accurate?
What is, was sort of an urban legend, like we were talking about, everything has a thread of truth to it.
Right.
But there was actually more truth to that. Luciano's role in the war, and I've talked to some serious academics about this to get their take on it as well, and I lean towards this. What Lucky actually did to assist in the war effort might not be a whole hell of a lot in reality. If you took the scale and you're like, well, how much did he really do? Not a lot. But he offered to help and he put the right people in place on the New York docks, and they helped put in place over in Italy before the invasion. So, I mean, there was some help. But how did he get out of jail after this ridiculous prostitution charge that gave him 30 to 50 years? He served 9.5, thereabouts. How did he get out? I think the truth of it is what he later told a reporter in the 1950s. He said, look, you want to know how I got out of jail? I'll tell you how. My lawyers marched into a certain someone's office and threw a big pile of stuff on his desk and said, get Lucky out of prison or what's in this file goes public. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but this is what he said. Now, when you look at that, okay, so what's more, I don't know, apt to be true? Lucky, you know, sent the mafia in Italy to fight, you know, for the Allies. Well, to an extent they did, but I think it's more realistic to look at it this way. What does the mob do best? So think of surveillance. The public figure, now that's debatable. Some people say it was J. Edgar Hoover. Some think it was Thomas E. Dewey. And for those that don't know, Dewey was the man who prosecuted Luciano. And a lot of us agree that he was politically motivated for his own benefit.
Right.
One of those two, allegedly, purportedly, was who Luciano was saying his people did. And there's other stories that it was Meyer Lansky.
Yeah.
And if anybody could have done it, Lansky and Costello and those guys, they could have got the goods, or let me say the dirt, on whomever. Whatever happened in 1946, Thomas Dewey, then governor, signed the release, said Luciano's out. It wasn't typical parole. What they did is they said, we're going to let you out of prison, but your ass is never stepping foot in the United States again.
Yeah, he was extradited immediately.
Right. And Lucky hated that.
Yeah. And that was interesting, too. Like you said, give him that huge charge for prostitution. I mean, I don't, that didn't, I don't know what the times, how they were able to pull that off for that many years. But like you said, those guys that he had around him, Meyer Lansky, to me, even though he was Jewish, correct? He wasn't Sicilian, right. I don't think. He was a smart sumbitch, especially when it come to the money aspect and the things that he done. You know, he had, you know, casinos and stuff set up over there in Cuba. I mean, he was a very smart guy. And then obviously Bugsy, you know, he had a great vision out there that what is, you know, now the Las Vegas that we know. I think that was his vision even back then of what it could be. And then Costello just, I mean, had the power that you would not believe in the stroke, especially in those days. If anybody could pull that off, like you said, getting him out of prison, even though that might have had that little zinger in there that, all right, well, if you're out, you got to go. I mean, it's still better than being in prison. Don't get me wrong, especially right. for the time they were giving him. But I mean, those guys had a lot of power. And let's talk real quick about Meyer Lansky for a minute. You know, I think he's one of these guys that gets overlooked, but I mean, the stroke and the power and the pull that he had to get all that stuff done, especially back in those days. And they said he was a pretty violent guy too, if he needed to be. I know he's looked at more of a numbers guy, but what's your take on Meyer and the impact that he had during that whole time frame?
Like a lot of them, maybe even more so, I credit Lansky's vision, not just his vision, but his action. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to look at it like, okay, I'm kind of in awe of all of this, which is what drew me to become a historian on it.
Yeah.
But even balancing, okay, take the awe out of it. Wow. These people, Lansky included, were able to reform an organization. Yeah, it's the underworld and it's a criminal organization, but they were visionaries, you know, to quote you. It was almost better than legitimate business. Some of the lessons that were learned from people like Lansky and Costello and Luciano are applied in business classes in colleges, though they may not say that or realize that's even where these lessons came from. So if that says, I know that's kind of vague, but it's like, wow, you can call them bad guys and outlaws, and that's fair. But remember, this is why it matters even today. This was a part of 20th century culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's Americana, whether you like it or not. It's part of Americana and, you know, political, economic.
Right. And there's that thing, and I don't know who exactly said it. It may have been Lansky. I can't remember. But as long as there's a need for certain things and people can supply that need, whether it be booze or women or gambling or money, if they're loan sharking, you know, there's going to be organizations like the mob that can supply that and they'll profit off of it. And the funny thing is now, and I had this talk with Anthony Ruggiano Jr. When he was on the show, a lot of the things the mob did and a lot of the things they profit from are damn near all legal now, except for the drugs, which in some cases or some states, weed is legal. But, you know, they're gambling. A lot of places now it's legal to gamble. I mean, hell, how many DraftKings and FanDuel commercials do you see during an NFL football game now? And I know it's not quite the same maybe fear factor in it, but a lot of these like cash advance places, they give you money at these exorbitant, crazy interest rates. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same principle that they had, you know, back in the day, running numbers. That was what they do, their version of the lotto. Now you can walk into any gas station and buy a lottery ticket. So there's a reason that all these things that they did to make this money were copied and then legalized by our government because they could see how much money it was generating and they wanted their piece.
Exactly. For better or worse, you know, the U.S. or state governments have a lottery that, you know, millions are on that. And as for vice, I know Seth says it in our documentary, too. Pretty much if there is a vice, it's supply and demand. Somebody's going to want it. Mm-hmm. Back there's debate among all of us, like how much foresight the mob had in the 20s and 30s. I lean more towards, I think they knew like prohibition wasn't going to last forever. There was no way they were going to keep alcohol away. Gambling, they might even saw that being legit someday because they wanted, a lot of mobsters wanted to get into legitimate enterprises.
Yeah.
Look at Vegas. I mean, that's eventually what they did.
Yeah.
Drugs. Here's where I'm kind of the school of thought that they never thought drugs would really be accepted. So there's always going to be a market for that. I don't know. We're at a different place today, but it also took almost a century to even get there. I mean, no matter where somebody stands on the whole drug thing, you know, I've changed the way I've thought over the years. And I look at it now like, well, it didn't create the gangster, but it sure as hell made a lot of them, starting in the 1920s. So, you know, you want to take shit away from people. No, nobody wants them harmed, and, you know, but gambling, prostitution, all these things, yeah, they're legal in some places. And to some extent, you know, narcotics are legal. So, funny how the mob fits into this, though. They were like the...
It is. And because those were those core group of guys. And I think out of the only, I guess the only one of them that really got, you know, murdered or taken out was Bugsy, is because, you know, from at least what I understand, they thought he might've been skimming some of the money that was sent out there to get the Flamingo up and running. But other than that, like what, Meyer died natural causes, Lucky died natural causes. Costello, I think, died natural causes. Now, I know Costello was, he got shot at, I think Vincent the Chin shot him, and it went through his damn fedora hat of how close it was to actually getting him in the head. And I don't know if this is accurate or not, but they said that that's when the Chin went on the run and he gained a lot of weight. And when he came back into town, he was so, you know, heavy set, he had the double chin. So that's where he got that nickname. Now, if that's true, I don't know. But I know that Costello at that point, that's when he kind of seen that maybe he was going to be taken out. And then he kind of bowed out and, you know, let the newer guys come on in and take the reins. But yeah, that to my knowledge, Bugsy is really the only one that kind of had to get taken out. Those guys died, you know, like we said, of natural causes. And there's something to be said about being in that game with those casualties of war, you know, those responsibilities, and that many people coming after you, that you can eventually go, you know, by whatever way the Lord chooses to take you out.
Exactly. And it is sort of the rare occasion, like Costello, you know, basically retired out, if you want to call it that, after the attempted hit. Natural causes, you know, cancer, Meyer Lansky, Lucky had a heart attack, you know, Bugsy, you know, Ben Siegel, that was, you know, that's kind of a mob tragedy there. We don't know, you know, was Virginia Hill running off with money? Was Siegel involved in skimming it, or was he just bad with money? I mean, like some people, you know, was he just not really good?
Yeah.
Or were there other factors? There's so many theories that it's like the JFK assassination. Right. There's people coming out today saying, well, it was an angry lover, you know, that did it. And who, but you know, again, truth is stranger than fiction. Even as a historian, I can't put my finger on and say positively, here's why Bugsy Siegel got killed.
Right.
I can't answer that. Yeah. Oh, by the way, the Chin, here's just a factoid. The Chin was a prize fighter.
Boxer, for
a
while.
That's how he got. Yeah. And yeah, when he ran off, it was, I forget if he gained weight when he came, or he
had gained it when he come back.
Lost weight. One or the other. He gained or lost weight.
Yeah, he was skinny when he did it. And then when he come back, he was a lot heavier, had a lot more meat on him. And that's where supposedly that was kind of got the double chin. Now, I knew that he was a prize fighter back in there, a boxer back in the day. And that had a little something to do with it. But that's another story that you can get into a whole episode by itself of all these
mob legends and folklore. There's always truth. But that's what makes my job fun. It does. And I love it, is trying to find even that littlest needle in a haystack. Like all these wonderful researchers and writers that came before me, and they, you know, they give us this wealth of stuff. I hope I find something to, I don't know, string it together, I guess is the goal. And then maybe when I'm dead or down the road, some other person's going to take what I did and be like, here.
And continue the story.
It. Yeah.
And we talked about earlier, like there's a need for things, certain things. And one of those needs, especially in this business, is murder. You know, that's just, this comes with the territory. And that's where your third book is. Was that your third book, Murder Inc.?
Yes.
Now, Murder Inc., Lucky, all that kind of rides hand in hand. That was around the same time period. What led you to going around and doing that as your third book with Murder, Inc.? Because some of those guys involved in that, especially Albert Anastasia, have some really, you know, crazy stories behind them. What kind of led you to that as your third book?
I think that one was probably the most organic to come to fruition, because, you know, while researching Lucky Luciano for a couple of years, you find, you know, there's so much about these guys from Brooklyn that were in this Murder, Inc. So naturally, as I found weird little, again, to say anecdotal stories about those people, I thought, okay, well, I think the next book might be on Murder, Inc. Like, just focus on it, but not such a narrative in this, I don't know, standard traditional way of doing it. I thought here with this book, there's just so many crazy ass stories about each of these people.
Yeah.
Even their wives and girlfriends. Like, this is the craziest stuff I've ever seen in my life. Like, Hollywood couldn't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. It was almost like a series of, I always say, you won't can believe this. Like, that's what I should have called it. But they, what they really were, for anyone that doesn't know, Murder, Inc. was a name that the very clever and colorful press applied to headlines when it was discovered a homicide crew of the mob had been operating for about 10 years. When it broke, then it was Murder, Inc. Great name. But it was really a group of Italian and Jewish hitmen that for more or less were on call for the larger syndicate mob out of New York.
Right.
And they could be used for other cities if they needed them in Chicago or Detroit.
Right. And it's a lot easier for people that don't, I guess, maybe get the breakdown of that. If you want, just say you're in Detroit, right? And you've got a rival that you want taken out, but you don't want to have your name attached to it. It's easier for people from out of town to do it. That way, well, number one, you can have an alibi. You can be like, well, I didn't do it. I was at the, you know, the baseball game that day. I couldn't have pulled the trigger. So it gives you a little bit of comfort in that, knowing that, you know, they can't pin that directly on the, even though they might have paid to have it done, because it's a lot easier for an out of towner, especially if they have all the info, to come in, do a job, and then get out. And I think that's probably what, you know, was the appeal to a lot of people in that business, is they can get them in there, get it done. They don't have to have any of their own people involved in it. I mean, people might know that, yeah, they might have been the backer of that, but you can't for sure say it was them. Is that kind of, you know, along the lines of what you've seen in that and what they were able to pull off?
Exactly. That what they had, think of it like this. You have the Uptown Mob, for lack of a better term. At this point, early 1930s, it was somebody brought it to the attention of the board. Hey, we got these guys in Brooklyn, couple little gangs, kind of rivals, but not really. They work together. And they're, you know, these are my words now, they're evil and they'll do our bidding. And what it is in business terms, in an organized crime, it's a self-policing entity. You can't call the police if you get ripped off or somebody owes you money or you have a snitch in the mix. It's self-policing. Where does the violent part come from? The mob wasn't created to be violent. The mob realizes as a self-policing entity, you need to enforce the rules. These guys were brought in either by Albert Anastasia or Lepke Buchalter or both, because you had the Jewish and Italian. They were ready-made killers with rap sheets. You could keep yourself warm in the winter with how combined of the main core of this group. So ultimately what the idea is from a business standpoint, insulate the bosses, have a hierarchy of how you pass down a sanctioned enforcement job, which oftentimes meant killing someone. How do you kill them? Is it clean? Is it dirty? All of those edicts would come through. to these guys in Brooklyn. And they would use, as you made the example, you know, Detroit, somebody needed hit, you want to insulate. Also, hey, Detroit guys, we can't whack this guy because he knows us. As soon as he sees us, he's going to know.
Yeah.
Okay, call New York. Call to the candy shop in Brooklyn, or, well, go through Anastasia or Lepke. And then they would be like, hey, send two guys out. Here's the guy you want. Go to Detroit. Go to Miami. Go to that would happen. Yeah. But ultimately, their job was to enforce the mob's rules. And yes, it included some extreme violence at times. And it also ostensibly insulates the higher ups.
Right. Yeah, that was it to a T. Now, what have you heard? What was probably some of the most violent ways that you knew of or heard of in your research that they took out people? Because it wasn't just as simple as sometimes as just a clear gunshot to the head or a pistol shot to the head, and that being it. These guys actually, I think, enjoyed some of what they were doing for whatever the reason may be. They took their work, a liking to their work, a little bit too much. It wasn't just a single gunshot and then you're out the door. They kind of took it another step further in some cases. What's some of the worst ones that you know about?
Right. They obviously, sometimes you just shoot somebody. And you have to remember, there was a core group of these guys. Mm-hmm. I say, in my research and over the years, I really think they walked a fine line between sociopath and psychopath. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, and I always say this, I am not a psychologist, but I can tell you from this research, these guys enjoyed their work a little too much. Mm-hmm. Not the extended network so much. Like, you might know these guys and they say, hey, Chip, I'm going to need you to take out that guy, okay, all right, I got to do this. That's the extended network. The ones at the core, some of their favorites was to hog tie you and ice pick you to death. That was in the early 30s, there were a few bodies popped up like that, and they were calling them bag murders because they would put you in a burlap laundry bag and ice pick you and then throw you out on the street. Then they got more artistic, creative with how two or three of them could get the victim wrapped so that they would actually be choking themselves and then ice pick them. When I say bordering on psychopath, I remember reading this. I can't take credit for it. It was a newspaper article in the early 40s that said, when all it would technically take are a few plunges of an ice pick to a man's heart to kill him, they tacked on 60 to 70 more plunges just because. Mm-hmm. So it shows you they really took it. But the most bizarre, I don't know, I think the story of them killing a guy in Brooklyn, they put the body in the dude's car and then let the girlfriend of one of the killers light the car on fire, and they all kind of celebrated. There was also a story that they lit another body, Puggy Feinstein's body, on fire in a little alley. And allegedly, one of the girlfriends lit the match to that, and then they celebrate. So, again, what was true according to the testimony and trials versus urban legend, we kind of have to balance it. But yeah, these guys, they apparently enjoyed it enough.
Yeah. Now, Lepke eventually wound up getting the electric chair. And yes, that at the time, and it may still be the case, I don't know if there was any other sitting bosses. And I know he was, Jewish, but there weren't any other bosses that got the electric chair, were there?
No, to date, the only quote unquote mob boss that's ever been put to death, capital punishment, was Lepke Buchalter. Yes.
Yeah. And there was a few other guys that got the chair with them, along with them. Right.
Right. They, the Murder Inc. trials, they tried to try and execute in groups, mm-hmm. is what they did. So Lepke was part of a three-man group. Mm-hmm. He went with Louis Capone and Emmanuel Mendy Weiss, were his mm-hmm. co-defendants. And yeah, they all executed all three. And they were, I believe, yeah, they were the last three of all the murdering trials to go to the electric chair. Total of seven guys from yep. the murdering. Couple narrowly escaped getting the death penalty. Okay. Because they had killed in so many places. There were, in 1940 through 44, there were three different counties in New York were trying different, like trying to figure out which one of these guys do we try for this murder? Right. Because we know they, all of them were here. Yeah, it was confusing. You know, I'll give benefit of the doubt to the prosecution, but I'll also criticize them because that was the fastest moving. Let's put them on the electric chair and move on. Mm-hmm. To me, that wasn't justice. Yeah, they were bad guys and sick. It was just, you know, like today we'd be horrified.
Oh, yeah.
If you took three people, just, yeah, that would never happen.
Correct. And I mean, like you said, well, Albert Anastasia wound up meeting a different fate later on. He got taken out right. in the barbershop. From what I understand, I think Carlo Gambino at the time was a little bit more behind that hit. But those guys, you know, they had to go to the electric chair. And I think more along the lines of what you said was maybe it was trying to send a message to get it to stop. Because I'm like you, that now, that day and time, that would never happen. And like you said, they kill so many different people, so many different ways. It was really hard to do that because when you do anything over a 10-year period, even if you're not even involved in that, I know a lot of guys that's right. never worked at the same job more than 3 or 4 years. And they're burnt out and they find something else. 10 years of killing people. That's a lot. That's a lot of bodies. And obviously, if it didn't come to a head until after that, they were good at what they were doing. And obviously, you know, back then there weren't DNA evidence and stuff like that like right. it is today. But still, they knew what they were doing. They knew how to make you and the problem and whatever the case was disappear. But at the same time, they were able to make points. And a lot of what, you know, those killings, a lot of those were to make points that, you know, this type of behavior or, you know, actions was not going to be, you know, put up with.
Yeah, exactly.
So after that, are you working on the El Negro book or is that coming out? What's the deal with that? Because I know that's when you kind of got in the works.
Yeah. I tease every once in a while mm-hmm. about this. So for those who don't know, California Central Valley killer Jose Martinez, aka El Mano Negra. He and I have been in a conversation for about 4 years now. Anyway, so I've been working on a book and I can't say anything yet because there isn't anything in stone, but let's just say after 4 years, hopefully soon, I will be able to announce that, his memoirs will be out. And nobody knows, like, Google El Mano Negra. There's some crazy news stories and stuff about him out there. But anyway, yeah, I just talked to him. Just got a letter from him actually last week checking in. But yeah, I can't say a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And plus, I don't want to jinx anything. But yeah, it's in the works to have the book that I've been working on with him, basically based on his handwritten memoirs of his whole life as a cartel hitman.
Now, were you, and I don't know if you can speak on this yet, or if you can, that's okay. But I know on your Facebook, is it America's Most Evil or American Gangster? This got a show on him coming out. I've seen you were filming something with that.
Oh yeah. Tentatively, the date is May 31st, but the new season of Gangsters America's Most Evil just mm-hmm. premiered for anyone that ever watches on Reels.
Oh, yeah.
One of the episodes of this new season is actually on Chester Wheeler Campbell from my first book. Last year, I went to L.A. and filmed mm-hmm. for a day. They were doing an entire episode on Chester. And I can say it because I actually saw it listed on Google, the date. It's tentatively May 31st. But Chester Wheeler Campbell, should be really cool because it's the first time there's ever been any kind of documentary done on it. And it was fun filming for that one. I'm curious to see what all they got.
That's probably neat. Cause when you're brought in, you've kind of been brought into, you know, say your parts, obviously you wrote the book on them. Obviously they want to hear what you have to say, but you, like, you know, everybody else don't know what they're doing with the rest of it. So you're kind of waiting like everybody else to see how they put it together. Is that accurate?
It's going to be just as exciting for me. I mean, yes, I went down filmed and I had a lot of assets like photos and documents. So I, you know, helped out with that, and put them in touch with like Bernstein, a couple other people, mm-hmm. but they also managed to get some family members.
Oh, wow.
That I didn't even know. So this is going to be, this will be good.
Yeah. You know? Now you mentioned Bernstein and Seth, we talked about earlier. You guys have a project that's almost to completion here, and I'm really excited about it. The trailer looks amazing. It's called Dope Thanks, Men. Man. With what you can let us know without giving away too much, kind of give us a brief synopsis before we wrap up of, you know, what it is, how you guys kind of came together to put this together, and when tentatively we can expect that to hit.
Well, I'll go work backwards. Tentatively, I'm not sure. We're in the final stages of the technical part, mm-hmm. You know, the editing, all the stuff behind the scenes. It's essentially a standalone, but probably the first of a few documentaries telling as best we can the real story of how this so-called war on drugs really started. Mm-hmm. It didn't start in the 1970s. It started 1920s. It really started before that, but the main players were a lot of names that became, I always say, future mob stars. Mm-hmm. People that were directly involved in the origins of what I call America's first drug cartel. And that word wasn't even used back then in that way. And a loose cartel is probably best. But the documentary that Seth, myself, Scott Bernstein, we brought in a lot of great people with insight, former DEA, professors, former gangsters, you name it. We've got great people to give some different insight too. There's some opposing opinions on this thing called the war on drugs, but it's really about the 1920s and 30s because a lot of the guys you've heard about were actually part of the birth of what would become a problem we still have today. I'm really excited about it. It was an idea we had, I don't know, 10 years ago to do. I was actually going to write a book and it was Seth's idea. He's like, why don't we like do a documentary? Okay. So,
yeah. And I mean, Seth can knock out some documentaries now. He's got some great ones. I loved, White Boy that was on mm-hmm. Netflix. I'd done a lot of watching on that when I had Curry on the show, and I would almost prefer to watch that as I would the movie, to be quite honest with you. I felt it was more real.
It's better than the movie.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot better than the movie. So he's doing big things over there, and I can't wait to see that one, man. I've been excited about it ever since. I think it was you that dropped that first trailer and I shared it on my own personal Facebook page. That one's going to be exciting, man. I can't wait for that one.
Yeah. I'm really happy. I wish I had more specifics on a date, but you know, this is the Hollywood thing. We got it. You know, there's all these things we have to do. But I am excited, and if it works out, you know, the ultimate plan, and this isn't giving anything away, it's just we hope to do it in eras. This is pretty much covers 1920 through, you know, 1940, mm-hmm. give or take. And then we'd like to do like the 40s, 50s, 60s, that kind of thing. Anyone wants to see the trailer, it's like a 2-minute long trailer, you know, go to Crime and Entertainment's page or go on my Instagram, my Facebook page. I have a Gangland Legend. I got to plug it so people know.
Oh, no, I was actually going to say, tell the people where they can go follow you on Instagram and, you know, all your sites for sure. Go ahead and tell them that.
Gangland Legend, one word. I have a website and I have to keep apologizing for this. I took my website down because I need to totally redo it. So I said, I took it down. That was ganglandlegends.com. But for now, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Gangland Legend, or my real name, just, Google me. But Gangland Legend is where I try to post everything, tag it like that. Check out the trailer. I think it's cool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's on my personal page. It's on the Crime and Entertainment page for sure. When I first heard about you and kind of dove into your work, Tierra Patrick was the one that sent me there. She's like, you need to interview my friend Chris. And we touched base and you sent me one of your books, which is much appreciated. And it's a great book for anybody that's into anything of this genre that we've talked about, be it, if you're from Detroit, obviously, the Motor City Hitman story would be up your alley. If you follow the New York stuff, the Luciano book is great. The next one I want to knock out is the Murder Inc. And then, you've got that niche and that sort of subject matter that just rings true to me. And so it's obviously, going to be something that I'm going to be looking forward to anything you guys do together or separate, because you all kind of have that niche that I'm a big fan of. I'll close out the show with this. Like I said earlier, the first movie that I watched was Goodfellas that kind of, solidified the way the mob worked to me. And I probably have to say, even there is that, and Casino is probably my favorite. The Godfather is its own deal, and I know that's kind of more the basis of how it was from back in the day, but I kind of like the little bit more modern films like Casino and Goodfellas. What would be like your top mob movie?
For a long time I've said actually Once Upon a Time in America was my favorite fictionalized. I don't know, like that epic Sergio Leone thing. I love it. For anyone hasn't seen it, it's like a sleeper hit, underrated.
Yeah, yeah. I had to track that down. It was hard to track that down on DVD when DVD started becoming a thing. It was forever before they finally gave that thing a good release.
Exactly. It's a good one.
Yeah, one of the probably my second favorite, believe it or not, is the HBO's Gotti with Armand Asante. I mean, he fucking nailed God.
Yeah, a lot of people would agree. Yeah, that was good. And there is a lot of really good stuff out there. The only thing, I think as a historian, I take issue, just because I'm a historian, with the biopics that create too much. I understand Hollywood too. It's just you don't even need to, create so much creative license. I even love the cinema of Bugsy back in whatever. I thought it was a great, entertaining movie, but I'm like, did they really have to make up? They could have done it, told the truth.
Yeah. There was a funny line in there when he goes and he's like, I guess that's Vegas or California, wherever he's at. And he pulls up to the house that he just likes and he's just going to fucking buy it. And he goes up to the guy's door, he knocks on the door. He's like, I'm, here to see the owner house. And he looks at him, he says, are you expected? And he said, not unless he's psychic. I mean, I thought Warren Beatty just played the hell out of that role.
Now that, and if that was written in, that's where I give the writers in the Hollywood, that's creative license.
Yeah.
Perfect. Just don't change how he kills this guy when really you could show, because it was crazy enough. Like, just don't make up a whole different scenario. But that's a topic for another day.
Yeah.
But I do love watching all of them. I watch them a certain way, though.
Right. Yeah, as a historian, you probably do have to look at things with a different set of, or don't have to, but you probably just do, just off general principle, look at them in a different certain way. You're still a fan, but at the same time, you can go, well, kind of like the mobsters movie, they had to put that spin that the guy had killed Charlie's father or something like that at the beginning. Yeah. You didn't have to have that in there. He could have wanted to kill him because he wanted to ultimately do what he did and take over and structure everything and put it in place the way he did. You didn't necessarily have to have that in there. That's that dramatization that Hollywood puts on there that maybe don't really need to be on. That movie could have been just as good with that storyline not even in there.
I agree. And hey, back when I saw it too, I was like, oh, this movie's great. And then, I'm like, oh man, was that bullshit? What? Yeah. But I still enjoy it. I'm not you know, a Nazi about. I don't sit there. Oh, this is.
Yeah.
But for my own, like, it's fun to tell somebody who's sitting next to you, you know, hey, like, hey, no, you know what really happened? This crazy story. That kind of thing.
Well, I think Lucky definitely needs his own movie. They did one on Lansky last year with Harvey Keitel, and it wasn't horrible. You know, but I think Lucky's probably the next one. Him or Greg Scarpa, I think, are the next ones that really need their own movie.
I agree. The Lucky one, I know that one's close to my heart too. I'm like, man, if they do it, they better do it right, or I better be involved.
Yeah.
So that's where I'll get cocky. I'll be like, my phone better be blowing up. I've heard there's already been stuff for the last 10 years. I haven't seen anything materialize, so I'm not too worried yet, but.
Okay. I'm going to put you on the hot seat really quick. If you were to, if you were to get a call about doing something with that, who would you cast right now of, you know, the It Guys of Hollywood? Who would be your pick to play Lucky?
For Luciano, I would go with a relative unknown in Hollywood. Now, for some of the other guys like Costello or Lansky, I might pick, in, you know, just how I guess Hollywood works, pick some name people.
Right.
But I would do what I learned, you know, some other directors, not that I'm directing, but taking that advice, pick someone that isn't as known, so it doesn't detract. Like, hey, I'm watching so-and-so this whole movie, and I'm not just going to say a name like Tom Cruise, and I'm not bashing, it's just, but you're thinking I'm watching, you know, Tom Cruise. That can pull it off.
Right. Yeah, if I had to pick a well-known actor, I think it did go out for just a second, but it came back. If I had to pick a well-known actor, I'd probably go with Tom Hardy. I think he could probably pull that off pretty good.
Oh, he could probably. I'm with you on that one.
What was the one where he did with the Krays? I can't remember the name of it, where he played the Kray brothers.
Yeah, the Krays. He played both of them.
Legend, I think it was, maybe.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And that was a great movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really good. Well, man, I can't thank you enough for stopping by the show. I've been wanting to get this one done for quite a while. You're welcome back anytime you want to come back. When Dope Men drops, if you guys get a set date on that, we can come back and maybe talk a little bit more on that, plug whatever you want to plug. You know, I'm just glad you could come by and share a little bit about what you do. We're going to put some links to your books from the Amazon. Is Amazon a good place to go to find a lot of your books?
Yep. When I get my site back, I'll have like signed copies, but for now, Amazon.
Well,
everything's there.
We'll definitely put that in the show notes on the YouTube. And when we put on a Facebook and Instagram, we'll go ahead and put some links up for there if you guys want to go and click and pick up some of his work. And be on the lookout, man, for that Dope Man. I'm telling you, I've got high hopes for this one. I think it's going to be great. And obviously, you know, when you get the other book knocked out with El Negro, I'm really looking forward to that one too, because that has got I didn't even really want to get into that because I thought we might save that for a later date, because that's enough for a whole episode itself.
Next time, believe me, we'll have a lot to talk about, but I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you everybody for watching.
Yeah, absolutely, man. We had a blast. I hope all you guys enjoyed it. Folks, that was Chris Cipollini. I am Hollywood Wade. And unfortunately, we are out of time. Tune in next week for an all new episode of Crime and Entertainment. Chris, we appreciate it, my friend. Well, boy, oh boy, I hope everyone enjoyed that episode. I hope everyone's been enjoying all the episodes. If you have, please go on over and give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform it is you're listening to. I think on Apple, it's like a purple star or something along those lines. I'm not an Apple guy, ladies and gentlemen, so forgive me. I'm an Android guy, born and bred. But, you know, on the YouTube, you can like us on there. Share the show. We're on Spotify, Google, Stitcher, anywhere you can find podcasts, folks. We are out there, and that is the easiest way to help us out. Obviously, subscribe, but then share the show to your social medias. We are on social media as well. We're on the Instagrams, Crime, the letter N, and Entertainment. Also over on Facebook, Crime
and entertainment. So just make sure you follow us along. We try to pump out good content for you each and every week. Got a lot of great episodes coming up for this month. You guys are going to be really, really happy. And that will do it for today's episode. I'm Hollywood Wade. That was Chris Cipollini. And unfortunately, we're out of time. Tune in next week on an all new episode of Crime and Entertainment.